I want to thank our lecture sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes this lecture series possible. And tonight, it's a real pleasure to have Heather Lynch with us, and she's going to discuss penguins in the Antarctic and their roles as sentinels of ocean health. Dr. Lynch is a member of the faculty in ecology and evolution, and with a joint appointment in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University on Long Island. She currently manages a project in partnership with nonprofit research organization Oceanides, which is called the Antarctic Site Inventory, which studies Antarctic penguins and their response to climate change. Her lab at SUNY Stony Brook is focused on applying quantitative methods to challenging ecological questions that deal with conservation biology. She grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., got her bachelor's degree in physics from Princeton, went to Harvard to pursue her PhD in physics, and several years into that, she decided she would much rather become a biologist, and she switched to organismal and evolutionary biology. And we've all been benefiting from the quantitative skills that she brings to the study of these biological, ecological problems. Please join me in welcoming Heather Lynch.
Well, thank you so much for the introduction, and thanks so much for being here tonight. I really appreciate your interest in these birds, and I'm really excited to share a bit about what I do with all of you. So my talk tonight is along the lines of Antarctic penguins. What do we know? How do we know it? And what might the future hold for these creatures? So just to start off sort of at a bird's eye view, and that's a bit ironic here because, of course, not these bird's eye view, but just to take the largest possible view of penguin biology is just to point out that penguins are widely distributed in the southern hemisphere. We tend to think about penguins as being synonymous with sea ice and cold and Antarctica itself. But in fact, penguins are widely distributed all the way up to the equator. So we really should think about these birds as being marine adapted species, which inhabit the southern hemisphere very broadly. How many penguin species are there? That depends on who you ask. But we have roughly 16 to 19 species of penguins. And I think the most accepted number is probably 18 species. But of these 18 species of penguins, only 5 penguin species breed in the Antarctic. And by the Antarctic, I mean south of 60 degrees south. And only 2 species, the Adelie and the Emperor, are actually restricted to the Antarctic. So again, we tend to think about penguins as being cold adapted. But in fact, we really only have 5 that breed in the Antarctic at all. And those are the species that I study. So my interests have been to answer this question: how does the Antarctic ecosystem respond to climate change? And the motivation is that the Antarctic peninsula has seen midwinter warming of four to five degrees Celsius since 1944. So when you think about the kinds of changes that we're worried about at more temperate latitudes, maybe 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, the Antarctic peninsula has already seen almost 5 degrees Celsius change in midwinter temperatures, which is both highly concerning, but also an opportunity to understand how seabirds and communities of seabirds respond to this level of rapid climate change. So when we think about climate change in the Antarctic, we have to keep in mind that Antarctica is a huge place, and climate change has different effects in different parts of the continent. In the Antarctic Peninsula, where I work, and also in the Ross Sea, we have rapid rates of warming. In fact, some of the most rapid warming seen anywhere on the planet. But other areas of Antarctica, particularly East Antarctica, are maybe not changing significantly, or in fact might be getting colder. So we can't paint all of Antarctica with this broad brush of warming. We really have a much more complicated picture. So to get back to the satellite image here, the area that I focus on is the Antarctic Peninsula, which I've put in a small box. So my mental model of Antarctica is that it's like a fist with your thumb sticking out, and the Antarctic Peninsula is your thumb. And the thumb sticks out into the Southern Ocean. And if you could drain the oceans, you would see that the Antarctic Peninsula is connected through a chain of islands called the Scotia Arc that connect all the way to Argentina. So in many ways, the Antarctic Peninsula is a continuation of Argentina, which is one of the reasons why Argentina has such a, a strong historical role on the Antarctic Peninsula, along with Chile and the UK. So it's not a very big part of Antarctica, my particular study area, but it's still a very large area. We're talking about 400 kilometers by 1,000 kilometers. And the question is, how do we survey seabird populations over this huge area in a part of the world that's famously known for being difficult to work in? It's not easy logistically to work in the Antarctic. How do we do that? So the Antarctic Site Inventory Project is one that I co-manage with an NGO called Oceanides, has been meeting this need via opportunistic vessel-based surveys. And so we just completed our 21st field season in the Antarctic surveying seabirds and marine mammals. So by opportunistic vessel-based surveys, what I mean is that we work off a variety of platforms, both private, small private chartered yachts, large NSF research vessels, and primarily actually commercial cruise vessels. So about 85% of all of our data collection is on commercial cruise vessels, the very same kinds that you would travel on if you were going to the Antarctic for vacation. So the aggregation of all this is what I call a multi-platform biodiversity monitoring network. A lot of traditional field work, we use GPS, we use field notes, and increasingly what we're using is high-resolution commercial satellite imagery. And I'm going to talk a lot about that today. So again, this project, the Antarctic Site Inventory, is a collaboration between my own lab at Stony Brook University and the NGO Oceanides, which is based in Washington. The net result of all this is that we hope to understand the spatiotemporal dynamics of Antarctic penguins and their biogeography as well. So we want to understand how they're changing in space and time and where they're breeding and why they're breeding in the places that they are breeding. We have six species that are the main focus of our work. Three penguin species, the Adelie penguin, the chinstrap penguin, and the gentoo penguin. And then three flying bird species, the southern giant petrel, the kelp gull, and the blue-eyed shag. So these are the six species that we focus on the most in our own work. And it's important to notice that the three penguin species that we study are all in the same genus. So they're all very closely related. They're very similar in terms of their body size, their life history, the timing of their breeding. And those are really the stars of our show, are the three Pygocephalus species penguins, or the brush-tailed penguins. So no talk about what we do is complete without saying a little bit about how we actually count penguins in the field. And the biggest misconception is that we probably count a very small area and we extrapolate to a much larger area, but we really do count every single nest or chick at the sites that we survey. What's challenging is that we usually only have about 2 to 3 hours, maybe 4 hours at the outset to count all the penguins that are breeding at a location, because we're working off commercial cruise ships and they will leave without us if need be. We hope that's not the case, but they won't wait for us. Sometimes this isn't so bad. You can see in the upper left, there's a picture of me counting a fairly small group of penguins. In the middle, though, you can see how it gets quite a bit harder. You have these much larger areas where you have obstructed views. And we are, again, literally counting one by one by one with these handheld tally counters. And in the lower right, you can see what happens when we get to islands that are very large, over 100,000, maybe over 1 million breeding pairs of penguins. And that's where things really start to get challenging. Experience has shown that above about 5,000 nests or chicks, that's sort of our limit for what we can do during a typical Antarctic landing, we have to start getting creative. And one of the things we can do are take these very large panoramic photographs, and we can zoom in and zoom in, and we can count the penguins off the photographs. So you can see in that case, we're going to count the guy or gal, we're going to count the penguin who's incubating the nest there, the one that's checked in the lower right. We're not going to count the partner. And so we're only interested in how many occupied nests are at that site. And that is, from a biologist's perspective, the most direct measure of the amount of breeding activity at a particular site. So the two stars of the show today primarily are the gentoo penguin and the Adelie penguin. The gentoo penguin is a sub-Antarctic species. So it breeds all the way from the tip of South America down this Scotia arc and down to the middle of the Antarctic Peninsula. So all of the known breeding locations of the gentoo penguin are marked here with those red triangles. By contrast, the Adelie penguin, like the emperor penguin, is one of the two true Antarctic species. It not only tolerates sea ice, it actually requires sea ice. It's a sea ice obligate, and its breeding range is circumpolar, so it breeds all the way around the Antarctic continent. So we're lucky in that there's this area here in the Scotia Arc, the Antarctic Peninsula and the islands associated with it, where both gentoo penguins and Adelie penguins breed together. So it gives us an opportunity to understand how these two closely related species, one of whom is a sub-Antarctic species and one of which is a true Antarctic species, how they respond to climate change in this area that's experiencing some of the most rapid climate change in the world. It also happens to be that area which we can access most readily using commercial cruise vessels. The chinstrap is the third member of this trio, and for the purposes of the diagram here, I've lumped it in with the Gentoo penguin. The chinstrap penguin is also an open water species. It's also more of a sub-Antarctic species. And so by and large, we would expect that climate change would affect Gentoo penguins and chinstrap penguins equally. And then Adelie penguins might have a different response. We would tend to group them in this manner. So just to give you a sense of how complex the data are that come out of the survey program that we run, I've given you this crazy matrix here. And this matrix has a row for every site we've ever surveyed, over 200 sites that we've surveyed over the last 21 years. And I have a column for every year since 1979, which for reasons I won't get into was sort of the birth of modern day penguin counting. All those little black squares are sites and years for which our project, the Antarctic Site Inventory, has collected survey data. And you can see that there are some sites that we get to regularly, year in, year out. In fact, we might get there 10 times every year. And those are the sites where we have this big black line all the way across. And there are some sites that we get to very, very infrequently. I've included in here all of the other published data that come from other projects. So there are a number of other groups working in the Antarctic, and we've included their data here as well. And you can see just at the beginning, starting maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we have a number of green dots, tiny little green dots that are hiding in there. And those green dots are sites and years where we were able to get estimates from satellites. And I'm going to talk more about satellites in a bit. We've got three goals with the project. The first is to track patterns of occupancy. We want to know where penguins are breeding and where they're not breeding. And that understanding where they're not breeding is almost just as important as understanding where they are breeding. We want to be able to estimate their total population size. This actually turns out to be a very, very hard problem, but it's also very important because one of the things that we want to do is we want to be able to help the krill fishery industry. So krill, we're going to talk more about krill in a bit, is the main prey item for penguins. It's also a commercial fishery. So if we want to make sure to leave enough krill left over for penguins, we need to know how many penguins there are. And so that's one of the main reasons that we need to know how many penguins are there in the Antarctic. Not only do we want to know where they are and how many there are, we want to know how their populations might be changing over time. Are they increasing over time, decreasing? And if they are changing, we want to know why. So at this point, as of March 2015, we just wrapped up the most recent field season. We have population data on over 200 sites on the Antarctic Peninsula and associated islands. So what will climate change do to Antarctic penguins? And that's a great question, and it's one of the things that we're working on. So for about 25 years, penguin biologists were using a model called the sea ice hypothesis. And the sea ice hypothesis said that those species that depend on sea ice will suffer under climate change, and those species that like open water will benefit under climate change. That makes a lot of sense. And so here on the x-axis, I just have the estimated rate of change. And what it's just simply showing is that we would expect Adelies to be declining, and we would expect chinstraps and gentoos to be increasing. So this is the sea ice hypothesis. So one of the things that I wanted to know was whether or not the data suggest support the sea ice hypothesis. And to get us started here, I've just put the breeding ranges of the Adelies and the Gentoos here on a map of November sea ice. So remember, Antarctica is at the bottom of the planet. Their seasons are opposite to ours. So November is spring for them. It's the beginning of the breeding season. So all these areas in dark blue are areas which in spring are 100% covered by sea ice. Areas in red are 0% covered by sea ice, and I've put all of the known breeding colonies of these two species on that map. And what you can see is for the Gentoo penguin, their breeding stops right at that 50% contour. So Gentoo penguins cannot breed where there's more than 50% sea ice in the spring. Again, Adelies are true Antarctic species, so they're absolutely not bothered at all by the sea ice. They breed right all the way around the continent. So clearly sea ice is a major barrier for these Gentoo penguins, which gives us some hint about how they might respond to climate change. So the hypothesis here is that declining November sea ice, so declining sea ice with climate change would lead to an increase in Gentoo populations. If you put all of the data that we have for the project together, circa maybe 2012, we find that that's exactly what we see. So we see that where we are losing a tremendous amount of sea ice in the spring, those are exactly where we have Gentoo penguin populations that are increasing. So this is evidence supporting the sea ice hypothesis. But you'll notice that all the action is going on here. With arrows, I've indicated 7 breeding populations whose populations are absolutely exploding. So you can kind of scratch your head and say, well, what's going on with these 7 populations? What's so special about those populations that they're really growing so quickly? And it turns out that these are 7 Gentoo penguin populations which are brand new. These are newly colonized Gentoo penguin populations that didn't exist 25 years ago, but now do exist. And you can see the classic hockey stick curve, particularly that middle one at a place called Bisco Point, where you have an initial event where you might have 2 or 4 or 6 Gentoo penguin pairs that set up, and suddenly you have 100, 400, 800. So these populations can grow very rapidly once that population becomes established. So we clearly have a number of events where new populations are being initiated by Gentoo penguins right here where the sea ice is declining. So the model here is that we have sea ice declining from the Western Antarctic Peninsula, and that Gentoo penguins are tracking that 50-degree sea ice line, so 50% sea ice line. So if sea ice is the major barrier, we lose sea ice. Sure enough, Gentoo penguins are filling in, and they're moving further and further south. And that's exactly what we see. By and large, we see additional colonization south of their traditional breeding range. So to try and actually map out exactly what's going on south of their breeding range, we did a trip on this little yacht called the Golden Fleece a few years ago, when we visited all of the penguin colonies all along this entire stretch here indicated by the arrow. And what we found actually is that, yes, Gentoo penguins are moving south into some of these areas, but they're actually not moving south as quickly as we would have expected. And so trying to understand the limits to colonization is one of the things my lab is studying. Adelies and chinstraps have a much more complicated picture, and I'm summarizing a lot of work here in a single slide. But to understand what's going on with adelies and chinstraps, we have to understand a little bit about the Antarctic food web, and it's a very short one indeed. So it starts with phytoplankton, which are these little microscopic plant-like organisms. Those are eaten by krill, which are not shrimp, but they look like shrimp, these marine crustaceans, and they're eaten by penguins. It's a very short food chain. Climate change affects both krill and phytoplankton at the same time in ways that are a little bit complicated. The way that we measure phytoplankton is through chlorophyll A. So chlorophyll A is a very crude measure of biological productivity. But like looking for your car keys under the street lamp, the reason that we're looking at chlorophyll A is it's one of the few things that we can measure from space that gives us some information about the overall biological productivity of the oceans. There was a very nice study by Matsugo and all, another group in Science in 2009, showing that we have major changes in chlorophyll A over the Western Antarctic Peninsula. So in some areas, we have sharply declining chlorophyll A, and in other areas, we have sharply increasing chlorophyll A. And indeed, this matches very closely what we see when we look at penguin chinstrap and adelie penguin populations. By and large, what we see is areas that are low in biological productivity have declining adelie and chinstrap populations. So in this case, it's not a physical effect of sea ice. It's in fact an indirect effect of climate change that's mediated by food availability. So declining sea ice means there's less phytoplankton, there's less krill, and so the penguins, the chinstraps and the adelies that depend on krill don't have enough to eat. So I think of these as this is really being a tale of two penguins here. And what we know so far is that Gentoo penguins are an open water species and that adelie penguins are a sea ice obligate. To that, we know that Gentoo penguins are increasing and expanding where November sea ice is declining. So they are able to take advantage of climate change in that respect and move further south. Whereas adelie penguins are declining in areas that have reduced biological productivity. And by and large, it looks like climate change will continue lead to a decline in krill on the Western Antarctic Peninsula. So a few other things that differentiate these two species. One is that Gentoo penguins have a less specialized diet. So they tend to eat more fish. They're a little bit more flexible in their diet. More fish, less krill sometimes. Adelie penguins, by and large, would prefer to eat krill on the Western Antarctic Peninsula. So they eat up to 98%. Krill, But where they're desperate, we find that if there's not enough krill, they will switch to fish. So again, they seem to be more sensitive to the loss of krill. So here I'm talking about, I use the term phenological plasticity. And what I mean by that is simply that Gentoo penguins are more flexible in the timing of breeding. So the phenology of breeding is the timing of their breeding. Gentoo penguins are much more flexible in when they breed. Adelie penguins, very much less flexible. They breed more or less at the same time every year. Gentoo penguins are a resident species. They overwinter near the breeding area. Adelie penguins are a migratory species. They overwinter very far from the breeding area. One might say, well, what difference does this make? Well, under climate change, the Gentoo penguins here have more information about local conditions that the Adelies don't. They're around the colony all year. They know when it's the right time to breed, and they're able to take advantage. When the snow melts out early, Gentoo penguins are there. They can take advantage. They can start breeding quickly. Adelie penguins might be hundreds of miles from the colony. They have different cues for when to return and breed. This is really important, and it's something that we're understanding better with some of the work that we're doing in captive penguin populations, and that is the ability of Gentoo penguins to relay their clutches following extreme events. If a Gentoo penguin's nest is flooded by snow or rain, it's able to reconstruct a new nest, and it will lay a whole new clutch of eggs, and it will could have a very successful breeding season. Adelies and chinstraps don't have this flexibility. If they lose their clutch, by and large, they're done for the season. Their next chance to attempt to breed would be the next year. And finally, Gentoo penguins, I think of them as being opportunistically colonial. So they breed in colonies, but they don't seem to require breeding in colonies, and they're much better able to colonize a new territory that opens up. Adelie penguins are obligately colonial. They have to breed in a colony. They have to, by and large, breed in a large colony. And they appear to be very poor colonizers of new territory. So climate change might be opening up new areas that are available for that might be available for breeding. Gentoo penguins would be able to take advantage, and Adelies would not be able to take advantage. So these are all the reasons why, in the penguin community, we think about Gentoo penguins as being climate change winners and Adelie penguins as being climate change losers. So this is the picture that we had before. This is what we expected, right? That the open water species would be increasing and the sea ice obligate species would decline. But what we're finding is something very different. What we're finding is that both Adelies and chinstraps are declining, okay? So the chinstraps here are rather an inconvenient truth to the sea ice hypothesis. In fact, we've nixed this old paradigm that it all comes down to sea ice. So a couple of new ideas. One possibility is that chinstraps and Adelies, because they do forage way out at sea, might be competing with humpback whales. So humpback whale populations are increasing in the Antarctic since they're no longer intensively harvested. And though maybe these penguins are actually competing with this larger population of humpback whales. Gentoo penguins are foraging right close to shore, so they're not competing with humpback whales. They're not foraging in the same areas. I think it's much more likely that the real difference between these has to do with a set of very rigid life history traits versus a set of flexible life history traits. And this idea that flexibility is key to climate change resilience, I think, is an important one. So Gentoo penguins are much more flexible about what they eat, where they breed, when they breed, lose a clutch, no problem, we'll relay the clutch. They really roll with the punches. And I think this whole idea of rolling with the punches makes a big difference under climate change. I think climate change winners, by and large, will have these set of characteristics that make them very plastic, very adaptable. So these opportunistic surveys that we do off the cruise ships are clearly valuable, but they have some limitations. And one is that we have no continental scale baseline against which to assess changes in population, because we really don't have any way, or we have not in the past had any way, to survey large chunks of coastline or to do continental scale surveys. Another remarkable fact is that if we think about what drives our uncertainty about penguin populations, if someone said, how many penguins are there? And I said, 3 million plus or minus whatever. What's driving that plus or minus whatever comes down to just 14 colonies. Out of over 500 breeding populations, there's only 14 that really matter in terms of our uncertainty. And I call these super colonies. So these are extraordinarily large colonies in extremely remote places for which we have no good estimates of population. So if we could just really focus on these 14 colonies, we could really constrain our estimates of total abundance. And direct counting is completely incapable of providing reliable population estimates for these largest colonies. And I'll show you a picture in a second which will illustrate that. So geospatial technologies really help us do intensive studies at extensive spatial scales, which is to say that we no longer have to trade off quality for quantity. We can do very high quality surveys at the continental scale. And by geospatial technology, I mean everything from robotic camera heads for panoramic photos to remote camera traps. We have a network of camera traps in the Antarctic, drones, UAVs, other autonomous vehicles, and finally satellites, which is really what I'm going to spend the most time talking about today. So using satellites for surveying penguin populations is actually not a new idea. It was originally done back in the mid-1980s by my colleague from NASA, Matt Schwaller, who discovered in Landsat imagery that you could see Adelie penguin colonies in Landsat imagery. But he was a little bit ahead of his time in the sense that there wasn't much momentum to continue to do this in an operational context until, I would say, in the last 6 or 7 years, with help from a group called the Polar Geospatial Center run out of the University of Minnesota, we've really ramped up our use of remote sensing imagery for penguin surveys. And you can see, if I were to put all the papers that have come out in the last 18 months by my group and others around the world, they probably wouldn't fit on the slide. Such has been the interest in using satellites in this context. So here's just a small part of a colony on an island called Zawadowski Island in the South Sandwich Islands, which gives you a sense of the challenges that we face trying to survey penguin populations in the field. And to make this even more complicated, you can see if you look in the front here, we have two species breeding in this particular colony. We've got macaroni penguins and chinstrap penguins. This colony has about 1.5 million breeding pairs of penguins. It doesn't matter how long we would be left at this island, we're never going to count all the penguins at Zawadowski Island. So if we're going to really start to understand how many penguins there are at these largest super colonies, we're going to have to use remote sensing. So by remote sensing, I'm primarily today going to be talking about sub-meter commercial imagery. So these are the very same satellites that would bring you satellite imagery of breaking news on the NBC or CBS, QuickBird, WorldView 1, WorldView 2, GOI, Iconos. And what you'll notice this by panchromatic, that's just grayscale. In the grayscale, we have now down to, it's not shown on here, we have down to 31 centimeter resolution imagery. So from space, we can get 31 centimeter resolution pictures of the Antarctic. In addition to these, we have WorldView 3 and several more satellites being launched just over the next few years. So we have incredible coverage, incredible resolution available to us now. So the six questions that I want to address today is, one, can we detect penguins in satellite imagery? Spoiler alert, I think we probably can. Can we differentiate different species of penguins where they're breeding together? Can we estimate abundance? Can we assess changes in abundance? Can we detect trend using satellites? Can we start doing global or regional scale assessments of penguin abundance? And finally, can satellites really open up a new age of exploration? So to this first question, can we detect penguins in satellite imagery? We definitely can. And here's just a screenshot of the four species that breed on the peninsula, the three that I've spoken about, and also the macaroni penguin. And I've put little white arrows pointing to the colonies in each of these satellite images. So they look different depending on context, but in all of these cases, we can tell what the penguin colonies look like. If you look in the upper right image, you might just faintly be able to make out some lines connecting some of those dark blobs. Those lines are the penguin trails that the penguins make when they're traveling back and forth between the different sub-colonies of that colony. And that's as sure a sign as ever that what we're seeing are penguin colonies. So that's the level of detail that we can get in this imagery. It's really remarkable. Sometimes we can even see individual penguins on snow, but by and large, this isn't what we're looking at. So you can see in the top image here, we have, these are Gentoo penguins on snow, 5th of October, 2010. 2 months later, 5th of December, you can see that what we're left with is a giant guano stain. And that is what we're usually looking at. So the penguins, they sit in these nests. The guano collects. It actually can get sort of knee deep by the end of the season. But because the nests are stationary, the shape of that guano patch exactly matches the nests, the shape of the colony. And penguins pack at a very predictable density. So we can extrapolate from the area of that guano stain how many penguins must have been nesting inside that patch in order to make a patch of guano that size. So sometimes we see individuals, but by and large, that really isn't what we're using. What I love about this picture is that these images were taken directly from Google Earth. And in fact, we get the imagery directly from the vendor, but I screenshot these images out of Google Earth and published them as is. So if you haven't visited Google Earth lately, I can't suggest strongly enough that you go home, you download it, and you start exploring the Antarctic in Google Earth. We've been working with the Polar Geospatial Center and Google to make sure that the best available imagery ends up in Google Earth. You can see penguins, you can see seals, you can see stations, you can see tents, helicopters, airplanes. Anything you might want to see in the Antarctic, you can see in the imagery that's available. And it's just amazing. You can explore the entire continent that way. And in fact, we do all our logistics and planning now using Google Earth. So it's pretty fantastic, and it's a really great resource for education. We do a lot of educational development work where we walk students through Antarctic exploration using Google Earth and also Google Street View in the Antarctic. So can we differentiate different species of penguins where they're breeding together? And here I give it a somewhat qualified yes, sometimes. So here is the same colony in the satellite imagery at top and also a photograph of it at the bottom. And you can see that the macaroni penguins can be distinguished from the chinstrap penguins that they're nesting among because they pack much more tightly. They have a more hunched posture. So what you're seeing in the satellite imagery is all their little backs. And the chinstrap penguins have a much more upright posture. They're a little bit further along in their breeding. They're at lower density. And we can actually see, we can distinguish the areas that are macaroni penguins from those that are chinstrap penguins in the satellite imagery. Now, it's only a sometimes because I would say that even if we can distinguish that two, A and B in this case, if I can distinguish there are two different groups of penguins, I can't tell you which one would be the macaroni and which one would be the chinstrap necessarily, unless we had really good maps of these locations to begin with. And so we still need to do a considerable amount of ground survey work to figure out that the ones inside the polygons are the macaronis and the ones outside are the chinstraps. But by and large, it seems hopeful that in most cases we can distinguish species. So can we actually get estimates of abundance? And here I'm showing you a very early example. In fact, this was the very first example where we tried to estimate abundance. So here in the upper left, here's the satellite imagery, and you guys see the yellow arrow. So there's a yellow arrow just pointing out a gap in where the penguins are breeding. And you can see in the photograph that I took at the bottom left, that same arrow. So that will help you orient between the photo I took on the ground and the one from space. On the right, there's the island there, the whole picture of the island. I manually digitized all of those different blobs that represent the penguin colony and used that to estimate an abundance of about 115,000 breeding pairs at this particular island, which is called Paulette Island. The only previous estimate we had was by my colleague Ron Naveen at Oceanides, and he estimated about 100,000 breeding pairs. So this was our first inclination that, in fact, we could get reasonable abundance estimates from satellite imagery. We now know from several validation studies that, in fact, our estimates are very good from satellites and comparable to field counts. Now, really critical here is, can we estimate changes in abundance? Can we actually say that the population has increased or decreased just using satellites? And the answer here is yes, and we were very lucky to have a matched set of imagery, one from 2003 and one from 2010 of a place called Bailey Head, which is a very famous, very large chinstrap penguin colony. And just using the satellite imagery, we were able to estimate that there had been a 39% decline since 2003. So that's a massive decline in just 10 years. And this was fought. We did this study because there had been concerns that this population was declining and declining rapidly. So this was using the satellite imagery with a very generous grant from the Tinker Foundation. We were able to go and do the first ground surveys of not only Bailey Head, but every penguin colony on Deception Island where Bailey Head sits. And what we got from the ground survey just 1 year after was 50,408 breeding pairs. So we counted every single nest at Bailey Head and came up with that number, 50,408. So that top number, 52,274, took me about 4 hours, but didn't cost us any money other than my time. That number in the bottom took 12 person weeks of time, 12 person weeks and $75,000 to charter the yacht to go to Bailey Head and spend the time it took to count all those. And for all that, what we ended up with was a very nice proof of concept that what we got were estimates of abundance that were statistically indistinguishable, which just gives you a sense of the scale-up and efficiency that satellites allow us to achieve, that we could get that same estimate from 4 hours of my time at the computer and save ourselves $75,000. Of course, we didn't know that. In fact, this was one of the best validation studies we've been able to do, where we had almost simultaneous estimates from satellites and from ground counts. What's amazing about the satellites is we actually get more information. So not just the number, but we can see the pattern of spatial collapse. So we can actually watch these penguin colonies disintegrate as a result of climate change in near real time. So we're getting a much richer database of information about which parts of the population are collapsing and how these populations change in space and time. So the satellite imagery is even better than just a number. It really gives us a different kind of data as well. So can we start doing continental scale surveys? And here the answer is yes. My colleague Michelle LaRue and I, Michelle's from the University of Minnesota, we did the first global survey of Adélie penguins, and we did this using high-resolution satellite imagery. We searched the entire Antarctic coastline and surrounding sub-Antarctic islands in 50-centimeter imagery, which is like looking for your car keys on the road between New York and LA and 40% of the way back. Scene by scene by scene, 50-centimeter imagery. It took the two of us 10 months of looking through imagery to get around the entire continent, so it was quite an effort. But at the end of the day, we found some really amazing things. We found about 230 breeding populations of penguins that we expected, that were known to exist, which is good. But there were six breeding locations that were not found, of which three we feel pretty confident have gone extinct. So the other three, perhaps we did not have imagery of sufficient quality, or we didn't have enough information on the location of the original colony. But three of these, we feel that sure enough, we have great imagery. We know exactly where these penguins should be, and they're not here. Excitingly, we found 19 new breeding populations not previously known to science, of which 13 we believe are new colonizations, and six we weren't able to determine if it was a new colonization. So there are some colonies that are so remote, it's possible that no scientific expedition has ever sailed within sight of that colony. So we can't assess whether or not it's actually new. But 13 of these are in the vicinity of previous surveys, and we think that if the colony had been there, it would have been noted. And since it wasn't noted, we're assuming that that population is actually a new population. There were 12 breeding locations of unknown status, which is to say that we didn't have cloud-free imagery to use. No one has been there in a long time, so we still have some open questions. But at the end of the day, we estimated total global abundance of Adélie penguins at 3.81 million breeding pairs, which is a 54% increase over the last attempt at an estimate, which is in 1993. So we really think that there's been a genuine... We found 54% more than we expected. Of that, about half of that we think is because we did a better survey, which is to say a more complete survey than had been previously known. But about half of that we think reflects genuine growth in the Adélie penguin population. So it's a combination. Some of it is that our methods were better. We have satellites now. The other half is a genuine increase in the population. But that increase is not uniform by any means. And you can see in this map that on the Antarctic Peninsula, our survey found, as expected, that Adélie penguins are declining. Okay, with climate change, Adélie penguins are declining rapidly in that area. But in the Ross Sea and other areas of eastern Antarctica, Adélie penguins are actually increasing. But those populations are genuinely increasing in size. And so on net, the global population has increased over the last 30 or 40 years. So can we actually open up a whole new age of exploration using remote sensing? And here, I think this is it's a yes, and I think it's one of the most exciting parts about this work. So just as one example, a couple of years ago, we launched only the third scientific expedition to a chain of islands called the South Sandwich Islands, which are a sub-Antarctic chain on this Scotia Arc, this chain of islands that connects the peninsula to South America. So the South Sandwich Islands are largely unknown, despite the fact that they contain about 30% of the world's chinstrap penguins. They have breeding macaronis, Adélies, gentoos, and king penguins. They're an incredibly rich hotspot for seabirds, but they are so remote and so difficult to get to that prior to our survey in January of 2010, they were relatively unknown. actually surveying these islands, in fact, was incredibly difficult. So again, here we use the Golden Fleece. It's our second expedition on the Golden Fleece. My colleagues, my very brave colleagues here on this trip, you can see that in many of these islands, they had to swim ashore. So they would jump into the ocean off of these inflatable zodiacs. They would swim through the reefs, and then they would climb up these cliffs to get to where the penguin colonies were. They would do 10 or 12 hours of survey work on the top of these cliffs, and then they would climb down and swim back. So an incredibly incredibly difficult area of the world to work. So one of the things that made this survey of the South Sandwich Islands so exciting is that it was paired with the first GPS satellite remote sensing enabled survey. So the last scientific expedition was by Pete Convey and several others in 1997-98. And following their expedition, this was the state of the art for penguin biogeography, which is to say hand-drawn maps, largely drawn by information that they had from ground counts, some helicopter surveys, a lot of offshore work, but still relatively crude in terms of our understanding of what was at these islands. With the submeter satellite imagery now, this is the only, I think, image of Zawadowski Island that exists. It took 5 months to get this image because it's an active volcano. So not only is it in one of the cloudiest places in the world, it has this active volcano. But we're very lucky, and you can see in the inset here the detail that we can get from the high-resolution imagery. We can see where all the penguin colonies are. We can map them out in precise detail. And so it maybe it's only, you know, 15 years difference from Pete Convey's work, but you can see that we've had this radical shift in our ability to map these populations because now we have this satellite imagery. We have this capacity. And so our understanding of the biogeography has grown leaps and bounds with that. So finally, what does the future hold for Antarctic penguins? And one of the major threats that people worry about is tourism. Is tourism having a negative impact on Antarctica's penguins? And I would say it's one of these things that my own group has studied a lot over the last few years. But our work and those of other groups have found that by and large, the answer is no. That penguins, particularly Gentoo penguins, are fairly easily habituated, which means that once they get used to people, by and large, they go about their business. Their breeding success is comparable to areas that don't have Antarctic tourists. And on the one hand, that's good. That's great. On the other hand, one might worry about habituation as itself being an impact on penguins, and that's something that obviously could be a concern. But I don't think that tourism is having the impact that some people feared that it might on Antarctica's penguins. It's a very well-regulated, very heavily managed industry. Definitely more concerning is the krill fishery. So as mentioned, the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic Peninsula in particular is one of the areas where we have a very active krill fishery. Where does all this krill go? It's going largely into dietary supplements. Some of you may see this, so maybe taking krill oil supplements. You can see it at Costco or CVS. It's an alternative to fish oil. And also aquaculture. So we feed krill to farm-raised fish to provide protein for them. So this is certainly a concern, and one of the major efforts of my own lab is to work with the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctica Marine Living Resources that's in charge of managing the krill fishery to make sure that we do so in a way that's sustainable and allows for the survival of these populations of penguins. I think the most concerning of all here is climate change in the Antarctic. Fisheries and climate change can interact with one another, so it's not clear-cut in some cases when a population is declining, if it's due to fisheries or climate change. But particularly on the Antarctic Peninsula, climate change is having a real impact on these penguins, and it's certainly a major concern because particularly for Adelie penguins and chinstrap penguins, it looks like there may not be enough that climate change is having an impact on krill. So we have climate change impacts on krill, we have fishing that's impacting krill. The net result is that Adelies and chinstrap penguins are declining across much of that Antarctic Peninsula. So will penguins be able to adapt? And here I just have to say, stay tuned. It continues to be something that we're working on. We want to be able to project populations 50 years out, 100 years out, and we're just not quite there that we understand their dynamics well enough to be able to do that with any care. So with that, I just want to thank the Aquarium of the Pacific for inviting me here. To thank my funders, particularly NSF and NASA, both of whom contribute to this work in major ways, And also just to point out that about a third of all the funding that we get for this project is by private citizens, both people that have traveled with us to the Antarctic and those of us who just care enough about penguins to contribute. And they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. This is the only Antarctic research program that is run throughout the years primarily by private contributions. It's the only charitable organization doing research in the Antarctic, and all of you collectively deserve a lot of credit for helping to support our work. And so with that, I'll thank you and take any questions you might have.